New ideas, thought-leading opinions, and the latest ways of working. This is the School Leadership Podcast.
High challenge, low threat. It just might be the closest we come to a silver bullet for school leadership. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the School Leadership Podcast, brought to you by NAHT Edge and NAHT.
For regular and useful content on the teaching profession, it has to be the School Leadership Podcast.
In this episode, we have Mary Myatt as our special guest. Now, Mary is an education advisor, writer and speaker. She works in schools talking to pupils, teachers and leaders about learning, leadership and the curriculum. She's also responsible for the book High Challenge, Low Threat. And the director of NAHT Edge, James Bowen, began the conversation with Mary by asking her to explain the core message of the book.
Engaging content and revealing insights. In conversation with James Bowen.
Well, the core message is that we like doing things that are difficult. And I make the case in the book that we are a challenge-seeking species. Because if you think of those of us, either ourselves or people we know, who do things like crossword puzzles, Sudoku, word puzzles, etc., in our own time, we're essentially putting ourselves under pressure. And once we've mastered the basics, we then find if we go on to a higher level and then go back to do an easier one, it's not as satisfying. So there's something about the fact that for relaxation, for pleasure, we're putting ourselves under some kind of intellectual pressure. And not only that, we've got companies who are making profits out of the fact that we like doing that. Because you go to any supermarkets, you go to any newsagents, there's yards of this stuff. Well, they don't give it shelf space unless it's making money. So we've got something quite interesting going on where, under the right conditions, we like putting ourselves under pressure. So the thrust of my argument is that we are a challenge-seeking species. We like doing things that are difficult, but the conditions need to be that there's low threat around it, that there's no one pointing the finger at us, making us feel stupid or whatever. So that's really the nub of it.
And you talk a bit in the book about testing, the link to testing there, which is an interesting one just to quickly explore, that you're clearly not anti-testing in the book. You think there's a sort of purpose to testing in schools, but you're very clear about the context has to be right. Perhaps you could say a bit around that.
Yes, so, and there's a lot of evidence as well that low-stakes testing is really important for securing deep learning. So that means that we want to shift stuff as educators. We want to shift knowledge from the working memory into the long-term memory. And one of the ways of doing that is to have regular low-stakes testing. Now, what's going on there is that they're short, that they are repeated on a regular basis, the key things we want our children to know, but that the results are private to the individual. And so there's a lot of cognitive science now around the emerging findings for that. So it's an absolute case of this cognitive challenge, but actually the consequences being private to the individual that are important there.
And I wonder if, well, I don't think there's any truth in this, both perhaps at a school level and a system level, have we got to the stage or have we been in a place where there's plenty of challenge? The challenge side, high challenge has been there, but perhaps it's been a bit too much high threat, both, if you like, for people who are working in schools, and perhaps that applies also, yeah, at a government level and at a school level. Is there any truth in that, do you think?
Well, I agree with that, absolutely. Yes, and that's one of the reasons why I've been doing a lot of thinking around this, that the high challenge is fine. We need to expect the best from ourselves and from our colleagues and from our pupils and students. What is not acceptable is the high threat. So what is going on then? I think both the department and the inspectorate are thinking, actually I do think they're thinking about this, that it is possible to have a system which is both robust and kind. Robust and kind. And part of this is, particularly when we're critiquing our own work and others' work, is distinguishing the work from the person, the work from the person. I can critique the work, but I leave the person still intact, still feeling okay. So that's quite a sophisticated piece of work to do, but it is possible to do it.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I wonder, is there any advice we can give to school leaders who are trying to achieve that? Yeah, when you're trying to give feedback to somebody, be that following a lesson, following looking at, how do you do that? How do you say, you know, you're okay as a person, it's this aspect of your work that we need to look at? That's quite a tough thing to do, I'd imagine.
Well, there are two things underpinning that. The first is that we need to have done a bit of work before we do any kind of quality assurance, whatever that looks like, on the human side, the human aspects of our trade, as it were. And that at its heart is letting people know that they're okay. So it's finding the odd thing that is positive about someone, and also as leaders, being open about some of the things that we don't get right. This is not a game of perfection, because perfection in this world, according to mathematicians and philosophers, and I agree with them, doesn't exist. What we need to be aiming for is excellence and brilliance, because sitting in that are some stuff that doesn't go well. So we've got to cut this notion of perfectionism completely, and saying that actually this quality assurance needs to happen, but we're going to do it in as humane a way as possible. So that's in terms of the general points. But in terms of when we come to do it specifically with another colleague, it's really important that we use distancing language that take away the personal from it. So I'll give you a couple of examples of that. So quite often I'm working with senior leaders and supporting them as they give feedback to colleagues, watching them and then feeding back to them. And quite often what they'll say is, I liked it when you did this, or I didn't like it when you did that. Now, the real problem with that is it becomes a personal preference. And we need to always be framing it in terms of impact. So when this happened, it looked as though it was having an interesting and a positive impact on what students or pupils were doing in terms of their work, in terms of what they're saying. Do you agree? And then the converse to that, were there some missed... I'm not sure about this, but tell me if I've got this right. Were there some missed opportunities when that question came up, but could it have gone any further? So we're always putting it in the third space as opposed to my personal preferences, because it's irrelevant if I like, whether I like something or not. The point is, what was the impact? Was it any good? And so some of the language to use needs to be quite provisional. So it seems to me, or have I got this right, or tell me if I've got this wrong, but this is what appeared to be going on and this appeared to be the impact. Because it then gives the other person the chance to come back and say, no, it was slightly different. It puts it in a much more professional dialogue of what was actually going on, which, funnily enough, removes people giving excuses. Because quite often, if the conversation is too brash or too harsh, what happens is people become defensive and say, well, if you've been there for the rest of the lesson, this is what you're saying. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this being symptomatic of practice over time and what some of the strengths are and what might need to be developed. So we need to get it away from being adversarial to a conversation of this is how it appeared to be.
And in both books, I've noticed, you know, you talk there about humane leadership, and actually you don't shy away from talking about kind leadership, which perhaps something you don't read in every leadership book. But also, am I right in saying you wouldn't want that to be confused with soft, fluffy? There's a hard edge to this still, is that
yes,
fair?
Yes, there is. So what I'm arguing for is that these need to be held in balance, the robust and the kind. And when I've looked at companies which are sustainable over time, so organisations beyond education, and then I've also noticed it's happening in education as well, but those companies that are sustainable over time, and what we mean by that they're healthy, is that they do well by their stakeholders. So that's customers, local communities, employees, etc. And they also return a reasonable amount for the bottom line in terms of investors. Now, what they do is they hold this balance of the humane and the soft with the hard metrics. So they're business-minded, but they do it in a humane way. Where they get it wrong and they just pursue the hard metrics, which is the bottom line and profitability, we get situations like Ryanair, where actually they have traded on the fact, it's been part of their branding, that they have complete contempt for their customers, and that it also transpires for their employees as well, and having to really really rethink about their model of doing business. It's not sustainable over time. And I think there are some parallels in schools where if we just focus on the hard metrics, which are the SATS results, the GCSEs, the public data in the public domain, again, that's not sustainable. They're unhappy places to be. I mean, unfortunately, I think very few schools are like this, but they are up there, where the only thing that matters is how we're perceived by the outside world. Well, education and teaching and learning are much more complex than that. So, but then, as you quite rightly say, if you just focus on the soft stuff, you can drift into all sorts of things that either are not our core purpose or are not holding people to account appropriately. And I'll give you a couple of examples. So the first is, you know, our core purpose is the cognitive development of our young people. That is what we've come into the profession to do. Now, sitting around that is obviously pastoral elements and safeguarding all this. That is important. But if we pay too much attention to that, so we're distracted from the cognitive development side of it, what happens is that we can have a misguided view, for instance, of protecting young people's self-esteem. So I'm thinking of children with additional needs, for instance, where we don't expect as much of them as we should or could because of what might be going on at home or in the wider world. And sometimes what happens is some of the professionals that work with them will do too much of the work for them or simplify it too much, so they have a sense that the work is done, but they haven't put enough effort into it. So there's a misguided understanding of building a child's self-esteem, which thinks they've got to get a piece of work done. But their self-esteem will grow doing difficult work over time and persevering with the right support. So we can drift into that, oh, well done, Johnny, or whatever. You've completed that. Yeah, but it wasn't. It was an adult who did most of it. And then I think at a professional level too, if we haven't got this clear in our minds, what can happen is I don't want to hurt someone's feelings. So this is to another adult, and I've got to have a conversation with them about provision not being strong enough. Now, my primary role as a leader is to secure the strongest outcomes for the children in my classroom, in my school, whatever. If I'm having to talk to someone about this, but I don't want to hurt their feelings, so I shy away from a tough conversation, what I'm doing is I'm compromising outcomes for young people. So I've got to be very clear-sighted about this. However, that tough conversation can only really happen if I've done some of the human side as well. Yes. That's why we have to hold it in real balance.
Yeah. And you talk in the book, I think that leads on to you talk about the need for radical candour, to be, you know, perhaps ruthlessly honest and clear with people, but also in a compassionate way. Would that be, perhaps you can talk a little bit about this idea of radical candour and what that means for school leaders?
Yes, so radical candour has come from a young executive in the States, Kim Scott, and her boss was Sheryl Sandberg. And not long after she joined the company where Sandberg also was, Kim Scott had to make a presentation to the board reporting how well her project and the team were doing that she was leading on. A lot of growth, a really strong story, and so plenty of good news all round. So she did this to the board, and there were many affirmations, congratulations, and the rest of it, including from Sandberg, her boss. But after it was over, Sandberg said to her, well done on everything you've been doing. However, you need to sharpen up your presentation skills, go on some training, get some coaching, whatever. So Kim Scott pushed back as a very able youngster and said, actually, no, I don't need to do that. I'm doing great. You can see the results. At which point, Sandberg came back to her and said, no, you need to listen to me. The way you talk, it makes you sound stupid. Now, what's interesting, she said, it makes you sound stupid, not you are stupid. So Kim Scott reluctantly took this advice on board. She's done a great TED talk on it. So she went off and did this course. But when she thought about it, she realised that Sandberg cared about her as a human being first and a professional second. And that was why she was able to take those tough messages. So just a handful of examples of what she'd done. When she'd first joined the company, Sandberg had sent out a few emails to other departments, other interesting individuals, and said, you know, networking opportunities, you might want to touch base with them. Did that linking. Would have taken minutes. Second thing she'd done was she'd invited her to join a book club. Again, would have taken minutes. And the third thing she'd done was every now and then she would check in with Kim Scott to check how she was, because she'd got a family member who was seriously ill. And was there anything the company, Sandberg, could do? So there were other things as well, but from those three examples, she knew that Sandberg cared about her as a human first, a professional second. And so she came up with this notion of radical candor, where we care personally about someone, but we challenge directly. So it's a very honest, invigorating space.
I guess you must have both. The radical candor without the trust and without the relationships could potentially be quite dangerous, or you know, that could be quite destructive. I guess leaders need to invest first of all in those relationships and that trust before. Is that fair?
You're absolutely right. That has to come first. What I'm arguing, though, is that it can be done quite quickly. We don't need to be sitting in our role for 6 years before we do this. I think it can be done in days and in weeks. People know whether we're walking the talk. They know whether we're coming from an honest and a deep space that is not looking to catch people out.
NAHT Edge is a union and professional association aimed at teachers with leadership responsibilities. Whether you're a subject coordinator, year leader, key stage leader, early years leader, Senko, or head of department, we offer full trade union protection and high quality advice. In addition, our weekly newsletter and monthly podcast keeps you up to speed with the latest developments in education. Membership of NAHT Edge costs just £13.50 a month. Find out more by visiting www.nahtedge.org.uk. And just to add to that, this Easter we're also running our member referral scheme. So whether you're referring a colleague to NAHT or to NAHT Edge, as our way of saying thank you, we'll send you a £100 voucher for you to spend on resources for your school. The new member will also receive a free place on one of our CPD courses. To find out more, just go to the NAHT website.
Come and chat to us on Twitter at NAHT Edge and at NAHT News.
It's time now for the second part of our conversation with Mary Myatt, where James and Mary discuss the thorny issue of dealing with staff underperformance.
Is there still that point at which, as a school leader, you may have to say, do you know, this performance isn't where it needs to be, and I need to do something a bit different. I've done, for want of a better word, all the positive stuff. I've invested in this person. Is there, you know, there's always that hard point where you have to think, do I have to take a different approach? That's a hard thing, isn't it, for school leaders, I think.
It is hard because we're dealing with other human beings and we're human beings ourselves. The bottom line is, though, is that if things are not strong enough or where they should be for pupils, it's my responsibility to address that, put in appropriate support plans. If those support plans are not resulting in improvements, then there are consequences to that. And I think we can't hide our head in the sand. Not everyone is going to be as good as they could be. But the point is, teaching is not the only professional job in the world. And there are some people who don't like it or don't like children very much. Well, that sorts itself out quite quickly. Not many of them. But there are others. And I think when you're talking about going down that support plan route and competency and capability, etc., I think, what I've found in my work is that where it's not working out, it's normally for one of two reasons. There might be more, but what I've noticed is one of two reasons. And the first is where someone is reluctant to change. So they're kind of pay lip service to it, but then it's not translated into action. So obviously, that's not good enough. And then occasionally, someone doesn't get it cognitively. They just simply don't understand what it is that they need to do, even with all the support in place. Now, there might be others as well, but we're talking about a tiny minority, but it's not something that can be dodged, because part of the leadership responsibility for which we are paid is to have some of those tough conversations. It's the humanity with which they are done. And the important thing is that someone's integrity and self-esteem is left intact. Now, I've been on the receiving end of some tough conversations as well, because my practice has not been universally perfect. Why? Because perfection doesn't exist, as I've already argued. But, you know, in order to get better, we have to have someone who is honestly appraising our work. But I know that actually the sharper, more precise, so the whole Dylan William and Ron Berger stuff, absolutely precise of what needs to happen, distancing the work from the person, so the ego isn't involved, but it's been really, really tough. It's actually had much greater impact than someone, and I'm thinking of occasions where it has been both vague, but also a bit sneery. It's like, well, I don't really know what you want me to improve. Does that make sense? Yeah, yeah. But we should, as professionals, actually welcome robust feedback. But I would also say, and it links back to the accountability, high challenge, high threat that you started with, is that I have the right to be treated with respect. So if there's going to be someone holding me to account, that has got to be done in a humane way.
And I just want to pick up one of the things you said there, because you said that thing about the two factors, and one of them being reluctance to change. And that's one that often, particularly when I'm working with middle leaders, when I say one of the biggest challenges, what happened? What do I do when I have someone who just seems reluctant to change? Is there anything, you know, from your experience, saying, do you know what works really well in that situation when you've got someone who just appears to be resisting change? There's probably no silver bullet, I'm sure, but...
I always have a bit of a scale in my head. Is there someone who they are, you know, in the right conditions or having seen enough different stuff, the scales are going to drop? I'm not saying that I'm right or the system's necessarily right, because actually, there are some people who are resistant to change, actually, for good reasons, because we might be suggesting something that is wrong. But if we put that to one side, and actually it is agreed that some of their practices might be counterproductive, then what I found is suggesting that they spend a day in another department, either in another school, or do something completely different, or follow a student around for a day, to get another lens on it. Now, they've got to be willing to do that. Not willing to do that says a lot about professionalism, frankly. Yeah. But what's interesting is quite often when people do move to a new space, even if it's taken a bit longer, the practice is deeper. It's very interesting. Very interesting.
And my final question, I put you on the spot here, it's very unfair, and ask you, what one piece of advice would you give to a new school leader?
The one thing I would say is find someone who's been in the trade longer than you and establish a hotline to them. You need a safe space where you can offload legitimately to someone who's not going to take it personally, who will have walked in your shoes or had similar experiences, and where they can wrap it up. You can then wrap it up together. It's not about finding solutions for everything. It's about knowing that psychologically and professionally you've got someone there where nothing is off limits.
Thanks ever so much for finding the time to listen to this episode of the School Leadership Podcast. As always, if there are particular people you'd like to hear from in future episodes, please get in touch, and you can do that via email or send a message via our Twitter or Facebook accounts. Of course, if you've enjoyed the podcast, make sure every episode comes to you as soon as it's available by subscribing on iTunes. Why not leave a review? We would love to hear from you.
The School Leadership Podcast, next time.
And it'll be a very special episode in partnership with Speakers for Schools, featuring the founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, and the writer and journalist, Fiona Miller. It really is one to listen out for. NAHT is a professional association and union for school leaders. NAHT Edge is the part of our association aimed specifically at aspirational middle leaders. To discover more about the benefits of being an NAHT Edge or NAHT member, go online to nahtedge.org.uk/join or nahtedge.org.uk/join. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter. Our handles are @NAHTEdge. And @NAHT News. We'll see you next time.